I'm a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
Here we are, another podcast week. It's been a little while, but we're back.
What's up, guys?
Oh, man, it seems like we just did this yesterday.
I feel like we haven't chatted for a long time. So I miss all the listeners that I speak to and never hear. I miss you guys.
Yeah, right. So, again, we ran another Cue It Up Cup. So we ran Cue It Up Cup Part 2. And that's why I haven't been putting out a podcast, because those things take up a decent amount of time, and I didn't really have time to pump out some podcast content. So here we are. We're back, though. The event is all done. Rob is insisting on doing work and having really loud beeps.
That was my brain implant. It does that automatically every once in a while. When I go into, like, this meditative deep sleep, it wakes me up.
Ah. I see. Your wife needs one of those, too, for whenever you talk.
I have one for her, but it's more of a shocker.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, we can jump into the actual podcast. So the first announcement is going to be a Patreon update. We have a new Patreon this week, and I want to give a shout-out to, and I hope I get this name right, Pete Silsby. Not totally sure if that's right, but thank you very much for becoming a Patreon and helping to support the future of the podcast. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon too, you can get more information by going to patreon.com/cueitup, or you can just reach out to myself or the podcast, and we can get you any information you need on that. So we can move on from there. I have ordered a bunch of sweatshirts. So I made a post on Facebook and asked if anybody wanted sweatshirts if I were to order them. And then I ordered them, and then I haven't really sold any. Some of the people that said that they wanted them no longer seem to, maybe, or they just haven't gotten around to responding yet. So I have about 50 sweatshirts that I am sitting on, and I am looking to move them out. So if you want a sweatshirt, we have a bunch of different types of bundles and some savings if you get multiple swag stuff. So if you would like one of those, please reach out to me or the podcast, and I will continue making posts on Facebook to try to get rid of some of that overhead, because there's a pretty decent amount of it. But if you want a sweatshirt, make sure to reach out to the podcast or myself, and we can get you hooked up with one. Those, I believe, are all the announcements that I have. We can move on to shout-outs. Are there any volunteers to go first?
Oh, boy, I'll go first. I'm going to do a personal shout-out to a couple people that I'll have to call them and tell them to listen to the podcast, because they don't even know it exists, I'm sure. But my niece and her husband, Melissa Shane, from Duluth, Minnesota. She's a nurse, been putting in a lot of overtime with the pandemic and stuff. So I'm going to shout out to her and her husband, Robert Shane, who is a officer in the SWAT unit up in Duluth. And he's been fairly active this last week or so. So way to go, you guys. I'm shouting out to you.
All right. Demetrius, you want to go next, or you want me to go?
Sure, yeah. I'll give a shout out to Mr. Tom Wirth. For those that don't know, he's the one that wrote this One Pocket, A Game of Controlled Aggression, which is the book that, Josh Filler was touting. You know, he had pictures of Josh Filler was reading this book, getting ready for the Tony Chohan match. And so I had to go ahead and get a copy of it. I knew about it. I don't know why I didn't have it sooner. So I went ahead and got a copy of this book, and I'm working my way through it. And anybody that wants to be a top flight One Pocket player, I would definitely recommend this book. He put it together. It's got a couple hundred pages with different pictures, multiple camera angles of actual color pool table pictures and ball layouts, where he talks about, like, what do you think the options are? And then he goes through talking about what some of the different options are, the pros and cons. And by the time you work through each one, you know, there's recurring ideas that come up, and it helps understand how to recognize different shots, what things to weigh when considering shots. And definitely you will learn shots you didn't know and learn concepts that are critical that you might not have known. So anyway, what a great labor of love from a fellow pool player. So shout out to Tom Worth.
Okay. My shout out is going to go to Chad Shoulders. And Chad has actually been on the podcast in the past for a TSPN podcast I did. But he actually won a $1,500 pool cue this weekend in my Queued Up Cup raffle. And that was pretty cool, and that's great, and that's fine. Chad didn't want it. Chad said, keep the cue, find a ways to raise more money for the professional players that are playing in my event as a thank you for putting the show on, basically for the fans at home. And it seems like this has happened a couple times now. It seems like there are actually a couple people out there who are really, really, really good for the sport and are doing some really amazing things. I know Ong Vang, I gave a shout out in the past because he won two pool cues in the same week in a raffle that was used to raise money for the pool halls that were affected by the shutdown for COVID. And he donated both of those back, almost $5,000 in pool cues he gave back. There's a lot of people out there that just want to see the best for pool and are willing to kind of step up and do that. And I think with the reputation that pool has, we need to really highlight those types of people and those types of actions to really help start making the stigma change in pool from a gambling, hustling game that is done in greasy, shady, dark pool halls to a lot of the actual good things that actually happen from the game, whether it's benefit tournaments or whether it's, you know, just supporting the people that are in it by donating something back that you won, stuff like that, where there's a lot of really good things that happen. And until they get a platform and shown that it actually happens, people don't know about it. So I really want to give a shout out to Chad this week. Thank you for doing that. That's insanely generous. And we're going to use it to have a couple of bonus raffles for the event that we did this past weekend with a bunch of apparel and signed stuff from the players. And then basically all of the stuff that was donated back. So there was other people that donated stuff back too after we had made this announcement. So it's a pretty cool thing that you did, Chad. And I just wanted to highlight it and give it a bigger platform.
All right.
So I guess with that, we can move on to the podcast. Right. So we don't really have much to talk about this week. Justin Bergman played a matchup. I don't really want to give that too much time because, it wasn't really a matchup. It wasn't really close, and the matchup just seemed kind of weird. Don't really know what happened there. I watched part of it, but it was, to be honest, I don't even know what happened with that match. So we're not going to talk about it too much. Just know that Justin Bergman won, and it was all done by TV Mike. So you can head over there and check it out if you wanted to. We will talk a little bit about the Queued Up Cup. I know that, Demetrius, you had a boot camp, so you were not able to watch it. Rob, I called and reminded you 10 minutes before it started, and you still didn't watch any of it. So,
not sure. I had to go golfing.
You had the priorities, huh?
Well, yes. And then I all of a sudden, I got very, very busy at work. So I haven't had a lot of time. But there was other things to do. It's starting to get summertime. Where does pool go in the summer? I often wondered that. Is there like a place for pool somewhere? But at the pool hall here in town, I used to have summer leagues. They went real good.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like a pool still exists quite a bit in Madison area, but I don't know. I don't know how the it goes for the rest of the country. So we can talk a little bit about the Queued Up Cup we did this past weekend. But just kind of on the outside looking in. So we got our butts kicked again, and I kind of, on paper, I think we were supposed to, right? I think Team Europe had some really, really, really solid players, and it's not that the U.S. couldn't compete, but our players aren't quite as finely tuned in this stage of their careers as they were at one point in time. But with that being said, we had a little bit of criticism for the way that the match happened both times, kind of just being blowouts. And yes, of course, we want to have these matches close, and we're trying to make them close. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's not an exhibition, and it's not a serious matchup. There's no money in the middle between the players for a gamble. It's not 1,000 ahead and winner take all. It's It's just a for fun event that we're putting on to get some pool content out there in a vacuum of pool content with some top players and trying to basically put on a show for the fans. If we could do that and make it competitive, that would have been amazing. Unfortunately, that just wasn't the case, and it is what it is. But just know that the people that are out there just like complaining that the events aren't close, it's not an exhibition, but it's not a real match either. It's just something that we put on so that you have something to watch. So if you didn't want to watch it because it's not close, that's fair. It's a fine critique, but it's better than having nothing, I think. And that's just me kind of complaining a little bit because that was
way better than nothing.
That's just me complaining a little bit because some of the criticism that I got out there was, it's fair, right? To be honest, it is fair criticism. The matchups weren't close either time. I think this time was more of interesting because of some of the banter that was happening between the players. I mean, the players are literally just yelling at each other while they're playing, trying to shark each other. And I think that added a cute little part to it as long as the banter was appropriate. But
it was fun, Nate. Yeah. It was fun. From what I watched a couple hours, it was fun.
Yeah. And we tried to make it that way. And at the end of the day, we're just trying to get content out there. So I hope that the people that were able to watch it, and maybe you even made your way over here from seeing that, and this is your first introduction to the podcast. It's obviously the COVID stuff's a little weird, so it's hard to get really interesting content out there about what's happening because there's not really anything that's happening, and the stuff that's happening is kind of spur of the moment, so it's hard to prep for it. It's hard to talk about it. I guess
we wade through it. Yeah. We get through it, even though it's hard.
Yeah, we find ways to just talk about nothing, basically, which is fun. So, Demetrius, you said you weren't able to really watch much of it. Rob, you watched a little bit. Did you want to talk about it at all from what you saw?
I loved it. From what I watched, I loved every frame. I loved the banter. You get a little insight to the way these guys act. What's their real act? I mean, you see them play pool, and everybody gets on a pool table. But who are they? How are they? What do they behave like? What do they talk like when they're not at the pool table? They don't say anything when they're at the table. But, I mean, what kind of people are they? Well, this kind of – hey, these are just guys joking back and forth and gals joking back and forth a little bit, doing a little ribbing. Yeah, I liked that. And the pool playing was great. I mean, it's always great. But what I really liked about it was nobody was perfect except for maybe Appleton. Or Appleberry, whatever they call him. Johnny Archer calls him Appleberry, I think, or something.
Yeah, Darren and played so good.
He just is really on his game right now. He's been working on it. You can tell even the way he was moving around the table. The one thing that I noticed, and I did, Nate and I talked about this one night, and I said, here's what I took away from it. I was so glad that they didn't run every rack, because when they didn't, I saw what they did when they missed, and they all did exactly the same thing when they missed. And it's something that we do when we miss. It's something that everybody does when they miss. They two-stroked the shot and lifted their head up at the same time. Every ball that I saw missed for 2 hours when I watched, that's exactly what happened. And it was all different players. Now, you could say maybe it's because they're not playing that much. They're not getting in tune for this event, the Cue It Up event, they didn't put in their time or whatever reason. The reason they missed the shot was the two-stroke and the jump-up.
Yeah.
No matter what was going through their head during that, but that's what I took away. And I thought that, if anybody's watching this and they're looking at this, they got to see that. And that's got to help them play better. I think if you would have watched this and took away from that the misses, your game is going to get better because you're going to see those best players of the world doing it. It was great, Nate. Did a good job, man.
Thanks, man. So, Demetrius, did you have anything to say about it, or do you want to move on?
Yeah, I think you covered it. Thanks for sharing, Rob. I think it is interesting to look at. I mean, you can learn a lot more from, what goes wrong. A lot of times when these pros are running out the tables again and again, it just looks like, they make it look easy, so that it's hard to learn sometimes because you don't really even notice what they're doing. It just kind of lulls you into a hypnosis where it just looks like Well, they just play great and everything goes in. So when you watch what when it breaks down, it's interesting to see where and what you can learn from that and all that. And then, yeah, as far as, like, the lopsided score and stuff, it's very tough. I mean, we did this. One thing I was talking with Nate about was that, you know, first of all, this is a live pool match. And you can't – the only way to guarantee a close score line would be if you, like, scripted out what was going to happen and we made it, like, you know, people throwing games and, like, actually scripting out, like, what was going to happen. I mean, when you have two teams playing in a match, you don't know what's going to happen. And so there's – you can try to balance the teams, and that's important. But at the end, it's like it's a pool match, and you just don't – you can't guarantee a close set, you know. And so, you know, ESPN used to have a hard time with a race to 9 because they didn't know if it was going to be 9-0 or 9-8, you know. And so it's tough. And the other thing is that with a team play it's when the score starts getting out of line, it can run away really quick. Because what happens is when you're playing by yourself, there's a couple things that happen when you're playing by yourself. If you're playing a race to 11 by yourself and you fall behind 4-1, for example, it feels like it took a long time. It took 5 games for you to fall behind 4-1. And it feels like you had to lose a lot of games to get behind 4-1. And so, like, maybe a half an hour passed on the clock to fall behind 4-1. And it gives you time to regroup. And then when you're ready to regroup and you put in an effort to make a good table run, then you can turn it around and then you can run with that a little bit and maybe try to fight your way back in the set. But some of the things that happen when you're playing at a 5-man team or 5-person team is that you fall behind 4-1 and you might have had one turn at the table or one chance to play. And then before you know it, like, you can just get out of the match before you know it. And then it can feel very, very difficult to mount a comeback, because if your team is struggling and feeling the heat, because now you're down like 5-1, 5-6-2, whatever. And it's like, you're down, you're feeling the heat. It's hard to turn things around. You're maybe a little bit on your back. And even if you are able to try to play a good set, if your partner's not there with you, or if they're struggling a little bit, or just, I'll tell you what I've learned from this format is the momentum and the being a front runner and getting the positive momentum seems to mean a lot in these team events. And that I've just seen it now that we've seen it twice. It seems like you could make the conclusion that Europe just plays, you know, that Europe's players have just had a skill edge, but you could also make the conclusion that whatever front running occurs is magnified. Like you don't want to fall behind in this format. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I agree.
So it's hard to guarantee a close set. That's all. It's just hard to get it to be close because of the format. It's very challenging.
Yeah. And like you kind of addressed it, we were given up, I believe, 100 Fargo points to begin with. I think that's what it was. It was about 120 or 110 Fargo points or something like that. So we're already giving up a little bit on the Fargo side of things. And then Sky hadn't been playing, so Sky hadn't picked up a pool cue since the Diamond Las Vegas Open. And he struggled a little bit, and he said it on air. I mean, he just didn't feel comfortable at the table. And then you had, you know, Johnny was struggling a little bit, and him and Appleberry were going back and forth. So I don't know how much of that was him struggling and how much of it was him just not being able to get in a groove because he wasn't taking it maybe quite as seriously as, you know, if this was a quote unquote real event. I think at the end of the day, most people had fun with it and most people enjoyed the banter back and forth. And I hope that that's the case for all the people that listen to the podcast. I know that Jim Telfer and I have been in talks about what we can do differently in the future. And we have some pretty cool ideas. I'm not going to announce them here, but we might be doing something in the near future with different types of events like this. So I guess with that, we can move on pretty much from this. And we can talk about one other match briefly that happened. And this one was a really, really good match. And this is one that I would advise people going back and watching if they wanted to. Nick De Leon and Chris Robinson played a matchup recently that Nick De Leon ended up sneaking out. I think he was getting 7 games on the wire to 27, and I think he won 27-25. And the matchup for it was, I didn't get to watch too much of it because my event was going on, so I didn't have a ton of time, but I did watch the last few racks and a couple racks along the way. Go over there and check it out if you want. It was a great match, really entertaining, and I mean, some of the classiest guys you're going to find in a pool between Chris and Nick. I don't know if either of you know Nick much. I know I don't know him at all, but I see the way that he walks around the table and I see the way he addresses his opponents. And he just seems to be a really, really, really class act guy. So that's a good match for him, and another good matchup in the desert of pool content these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess with that, we can move on to the upcoming events. So, absolutely nothing. That's the response. There's pretty much nothing going on coming up. But there is kind of an exciting... the Texas Open has now actually at least been announced that it's going to happen September 1st through the 7th. That's completely dependent on what the situation in the country looks like at that point. I think that's... I mean, unless you guys know of something that I don't, I think that's the first big pool tournament that's been announced... at least the earliest one. I haven't seen anything else of either of you.
No, I haven't heard anybody commit to something. I've seen people like, I don't know, I feel like some tournaments have been perpetually postponed indefinitely to where they haven't committed to a date, like whether that's, you know, the U.S. Open or whether that's the Super Billiard Expo. I don't know that any of them have firmed up a date. I think they just continue to postpone. So that, from what I can hear, that's, at least to my knowledge, that is the first tournament where somebody's committed to a date. And that's pretty exciting. Maybe I should sign up now before it fills up.
Yeah. What is the next tournament you're going to play in, Demi?
Well, I, right now, I just, like I said, I mean, until, I don't even, it's hard to even imagine going to tournaments right now. Number one, people have to start having them again. And then number two, you know, I have to make sure that, you know, I feel comfortable traveling and doing this kind of a thing, but I have a hunch that by the time that the tournaments commit and by the time we're getting groups of people together in a pool room to play tournaments, hopefully I'll be at a spot where I feel comfortable then participating. So sure. But I've been hitting balls, you know, every day. I'm practicing hard. I'm looking forward to it. That's for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, I think all pool players, we all have to know. You know, we can't, there's no tournaments out there, there's no leagues, there's, you know, some of us don't have tables at home, but the ones that do, oh yeah, I'm after it every day. Every day.
I wish I could start playing pool again. That would be so neat. Maybe sometime soon.
I was even shooting the billiard balls as pocket pool balls on my table into the corners. Just for kicks, saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this for a while.
You know? Well, the number of balls dropping into pockets was probably about the same for you.
I see what you did there. I see what you did. That was a savage thing you just did, Demetrius, but it was funny. I like it.
No, that was cute. Yeah.
Yeah,
so, life's little realities do we have. Let's have a wake-up call, folks.
Yeah. So anybody who's listening to the podcast, maybe for the first time, this is normally where we would talk about things that are coming up. Like I said, there's not really anything that's going on. So usually we just start ad-libbing stuff and maybe talking about different things. And usually a discussion happens out of it, basically in the place of what would be normal content. So we're going to skip that for this week. And we're going to move on to the end of the discussion. So we decided a fun conversation to have today would be to basically give maybe not our Mount Rushmore, but, you know, maybe the top 2, 3, 4, something like that, of the biggest pool moments that we've had individually in our own careers. So basically, if you were to write an obituary or, you know, the greatest, you know, if you were going to create a Wikipedia page for any of us, what would be some of the top highlights that you would have to have on that basically forum to really express the type of careers that we've had and whatever we decided to do? So hopefully that came off all right. And Dimitri, or Rob, would you want to go first with that?
Yeah, I'll throw a couple out here. I have to set the stage for this so all pool players can relate to this situation. But I'm in a team event, and a 5-person team out in Vegas in the open division team event. Only like 12 grand on the line or whatever for the team. So, and we're playing for, I don't know, maybe 9th through 12th. We're up there. Doing pretty good. We're on the winner's side, rolling along. And I'm sitting at the table behind the table the spectators sit at an angle where if I look at the table, I can see right over the top, straight ahead is the corner pocket, the upper left-hand corner pocket, and I can look, my angle is right toward the side. From the corner pocket to the side is my visual. Well, the score is 11-11 with a very, very good, a very strong, in fact, I think they went on to win it, Canadian team, a loaded Canadian team. And my friend is taking the shot. He's got one ball and then the eight ball. And he's over on that side pocket side, and he's shooting toward me. I'm looking right at his face when he's over the ball. And the ball is, the cue ball is a little bit on the rail right in front of him. And the ball he's shooting is just maybe 4 inches out of the corner pocket where I'm sitting. So I'm looking straight at him and the shot. And it's a puppy shot with the eight ball down in the corner pocket hanging there, basically. I mean, we're going to go ahead 12-11. This is pretty big. It's a critical moment, and he's taking his time, and he's a very, very serious pool player and a very good one. Played in the cities for a while. Was playing with Jamie Pluta and those guys for a while and starting to play even with those guys. But anyways, he gonna shoot the shot, and I'm focused on his shot, and he's focused on the shot, and he strokes very committed and rolls the top of the cue over the top of the cue ball about 7 or 8 inches straight forward and then stops.
Smothers it.
And
yeah,
now he's looking at, and he doesn't move. Now the cue ball is still on top of the cue ball, and he looks up. And I'm looking straight in his eyes. And I gave him, like, the okay sign, you know. It's okay, buddy. nice stroke. And he had this then all of a sudden, the wash and the paleness and the droopiness in his face comes over. Like, did I really just do that in this situation? And, you know, very calmly picked his stick up, picked the cue ball up, and went over and handed it to his opponent, who was getting out of his seat, of course. Couldn't believe what was going on. That moment, pool moment in my life that will always stick with me, because his particular kind of underreaction to what just happened. A lot of guys, I don't know what they would have done in that, but what are you going to do?
I mean, yeah, it's funny. Well, you think he was just zoned out? I mean, was he so detached that he just kind of was numb or detached?
Or do you think he was just in shock?
Yeah, he just couldn't believe it. Yeah.
He just went into shock because he couldn't believe he just did that. And he froze. And that's when our eyes met. we did talk about that later out at dinner in Vegas that night and stuff. But that, for me, going back in time, visualizing a particular pool thing that happened, and also to talk about your motivation and things and appreciating pool for the fact that you're playing it. One of my other big memories is losing over in a tournament in Red Wing at a casino in Minnesota back in the day to a fella named Louis Lemke, who I drew my opening round, and it was loser break, race to nine on a bar table, nine ball. And I lost to Louis Lemke 9-0 on loser breaks. And my takeaway from that is there is simply no possible ways other than the ways I lost every single game differently than you can imagine. And I was not unhappy with that with that final score. And Louis was a little bit, he in fact, in like game seven, he looked at me and he kind of shook his head and he went, boy, I don't know what else can happen to you.
Were you playing poorly, or was he playing good, or were things just kind of funny happening? Were balls just lining up for you? Just a little of everything?
Every game, I shot, broke, make a ball. I pocketed a ball in a break every game. And two of those games I scratched, of course. So that ain't going to help you at all. But so there was that. But every single game during the course of the runout, I got to the eight twice.
Wow.
And, yeah. No.
Isn't that funny?
I had a nipple and scratched to the other side coming down the
table. I made a comeback. I was down 6-0 in a race to seven. Loser breaks. And somehow I won seven racks in a row of eight ball against a pretty good level player, in a loser breaks format. I don't know really how that happened, but that was pretty funny. It's just a funny game, you know?
So you don't have to win. You don't have to play great to take something away from a game if you love the game. It's not a matter of making yourself happy while you play. It's a matter of creating a memory, whatever it is, you know? So, yeah. I mean, that's a super memory for me. A loss, 9-0 on loser breaks. It's a super memory.
Funny.
You know, it can't be hardly compared to anything.
Yeah, you know, I kind of like the direction Rob's going. You know, because here's the thing. I was thinking about high watermark moments, high runs, and, you know, I was thinking of the events that stand out in my mind. You know, the first time I when I was a kid, the first time I beat this player that was my childhood hero and, you know, finally getting to the point where I could beat him. And then, you know, the first time I won a tournament, you know, in terms of like the state level in Minnesota, where I beat some of the guys that I'd been watching for years that I thought were beyond me. But my first win against a pro in a tournament, all these are fun stories, and I've got some really interesting highlights, but I don't hold them that tightly. You know, I've got many high watermark moments that are fun and enjoyable. But none of them really stand out from each other because it's just I've enjoyed it all. But I like what Rob is saying, where some of the most humorous and stunning, funny things that can happen on the other end of things. And so I'll tell you, man, I think that one of the funny things that happened to me that stands out as a very fun loss was I played Johnny Archer in the U.S. Open. Probably 2000, it actually was 2009. And it was right after he got inducted to the Hall of Fame on the Thursday night. They had the big dinner for him. And I played him on Friday morning. And he was playing really, really well. This is, you know, 11 years ago. And I was playing pretty well. I made the final 16 on the winner's side, which is, I think, my best U.S. Open finish. And then I was playing him on the loser's side. And he had me 6-2. And I won a few racks to get down 7-6 going to 11. And then I three fouled them to go to 7-7. And then at 7-7.
That had to be nice.
And then at 7-7, we had the safety battle on the 8 ball. And he left me end rail to end rail on the 8 ball. And the 9 ball was out in front of the corner pocket, maybe about 6 inches. So basically, if you make the 8, it's game ball. And here I am, and this is, you know, day 5 of the U.S. Open. You've got the, you know, full bleachers, and you know, people are watching. And I remember looking at this 8 ball, and I remember thinking, wait a minute. This is awesome. I've been looking forward to this my whole life. I mean, here it was, you know, 15 years ago. I was a teenager practicing in my basement, dreaming about being in the U.S. Open and dreaming about playing Johnny Archer. And I remember practicing, shooting off the end rail, making length of the table banks, dreaming about making a shot like that against against Johnny in the U.S. Open. Now, here I am, U.S. Open, length of the table bank on the 8, full of grandstands. I mean, yeah, I'm not in the finals, but, like, I couldn't be happier that here I am, you know, here I am. And it was so awesome. And I was like, I could do this. I've been waiting for this my whole life. And I chalked up, and I got down, and I shot that 8 ball. And the thing split the wicket. It was beautiful. The crowd's all applauding. It was great. And then I looked over at this 9 ball sitting in front of the corner. And the word I've used for this is trapezoiding. There are times when pressure can hit you so hard that when you look at the pool table, it doesn't even look like a pool table anymore. It looks like some alien nightmarish trapezoid shape you've never even seen before, where it's like all the angles are wrong and the colors are wrong, and it's like some weird dimensions. It's like some Picasso pool table. And I looked at this pool table, and I looked at the nine ball, and it's like the pocket disappeared. And here I am, like the nine ball sitting in front of the pocket, but the cue ball's up in the kitchen. I've got 7 feet between me. Maybe I was even bridged, not off the rail, but maybe I was using some type of rail bridge. But the thing just looked impossible. And I just, everything was moving, and it's like the contact points jumping around, and everything went south, man. And I just couldn't do it. And I got down, and I missed the nine ball, and then I don't even know. I blinked, and I lost 11-7. And I absolutely, it was probably the most epic meltdown I've ever had under pressure, where I went from being so dialed in on the eight ball, and then realizing after I made that, I just was so confident that that was game ball, but all of a sudden it just all went sideways. And it was just, it was the, like, looking back, I can't help but just smile and be like, man, that was... That was one of my favorite meltdowns. So I've had a few. There's some honorable mentions, but that has to be, you know, and some, and I'll tell you, this isn't even a pool story, but I just in terms of, like, I remember playing at a tournament in Florida, and I had a big match coming up, and I won't even talk about the match and what happened. I'll just say this. I remember having to go for a drive in my rental car before the match to calm down. And I remember just, like, driving down this country road and then pulling over by this, like, you know, building that was whatever on this country road, and just walking out behind the building and watching the sunset and being so anxious that I felt like I was going to throw up. And I just remembered, like, completely, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of, like, feel like talking to somebody, but then you go through your cell phone and you see all these names and you don't even feel like you can talk to anybody, because you're just like, you're in such a different spot. You're so far out there that you're just like, it's just, there's just nothing to do. You're on your own. There's nothing anybody could say. You know, you just got to deal with it. And anyway, man, I just think about some of these moments where, those are the fun moments for me. And yeah, I've got some high water marks that have been enjoyable, but I think it's, I think the meltdowns are more fun. So those are a couple of my favorites.
Yeah. So I guess, most of mine, I mean, I've had a decent career. I haven't done a lot of great things, but I think the highlight of my career, thus far, I think it was actually winning probably back-to-back-to-back state masters titles. And I did this with a collection of basically three guys. It was myself, Kyle Burse, and Joe Krebs. And then we had rotated people in, because basically in Wisconsin, if you are a double-A player, so I don't know how your state does rankings, but in Wisconsin, there is a B, A, double A, and a master player. Master players is the highest you can be, and the double A player is right below that, and then so on and so forth down the line. And so the master's event in Wisconsin, the state master's event, allows you to have two master players and three double A players or below per team. And between Kyle, myself, and Joe, which were the solid, or the three players that were there the whole time, we actually won back-to-back-to-back titles, which I don't think has ever been done in Wisconsin. In fact, maybe Rob, you can jump in and tell me if you think I'm wrong. You've been around a little bit longer than I have, but I don't think it's been done.
With the BCA, I think 2 years was the most that there had been repeat winners in the team event in the Master Division.
Yeah.
From 2001 through 2014.
Yeah, and so we went back to back to back, and we actually, this year, we lost our first match and actually won our next, I believe, eight matches to get back and actually win the first set of the double dip, and then we lost on the hill. We had to win one of the last three games. We were 12 to 10, we were up with three games left, and they basically, the guy that I played broke and ran against me, another player had made one of the runouts that I mean, one of the best runouts I've ever seen in that type of moment, and then the other player just couldn't win a safety battle. It was just in a bad situation, just couldn't win a safety battle. So we ended up losing and getting second place. So we almost went back to back to back to back, which would have been cool. But that was probably my career. That was probably the highlight, just because it's a really cool thing and it's a team event, and I love team events. But I think what I really want to talk about, and this is going to be a long lead up, but I think starting the podcast has been the height. I mean, this, if there was ever a Wikipedia page made on me, I think that this has to be the first thing. But that's not the thing I'm most proud of. So let's start here. The podcast has allowed me to really bring on a lot of interesting players. I mean, I've had, of course, Sky Woodward on my podcast, John Schmidt after he broke the record. I've had players like Tyler Stier on the podcast, Rodney Morris, Florian Kohler, Raleigh Williams, you name it across the industry. I've had a lot of the top players on, and I've built friendships with some of these people. They don't just come on and that's it. I actually continue speaking with some of these people and build, kind of small friendships with some of them, some of them even better friendships. I think the biggest thing I'm proud of with what I have done in the industry was at the Moscone Cup this year, where not only was it really, really cool to look out into the crowd and actually see queued up t-shirts, some of which I've never actually met before. I didn't even know who they were. They were just wearing my t-shirt. That was really, really humbling and cool. But the cool part about it was actually a couple of families coming up to me and saying, "Hey, Nate, we listened to your podcast. We really like it. Meet." And then they'd show me their son or their daughter, and I would get to actually interact with them. And on top of that, I was actually able to take some of those kids and actually introduce them to the pros that I've built friendships with. So I was able to actually text Max Eberle while I was out there, and I got to bring the kids over to meet Max Eberle and Florian Kohler. I was able to actually take people that are big fans of these people and actually be a medium between them and the players that they look up to. And that was really, really, really cool thing that I mean, I'm probably the most proud of in my career to date is the ability to be a medium between the heroes that people look up to and the fans that want to meet them and interact with them. And I just think that was a really, really cool thing that I was able to do at the Moscone Cup. And that's probably what I'm most proud of for my career thus far.
That's pretty cool, man. I really like the community, and the pros and pool have gotten very accessible, and what you've been doing to kind of bring it into every living room, or every pool room, I should say, or every basement is very cool. Rob, I wanted to tell you guys one quick story. This doesn't quite fit in, but I wanted to work this in. So I was playing one time. I was at a tournament. We were warming up before a match, and there's a guy I know. I've known him a long time, and he just wanted to play some 5-rack 9-ball right before the tournament. And so we're playing on a valley bar table. Very important. We're playing on a valley bar table, playing 5-rack 9-ball before the match. And, you figure if you're going to play somebody real quick, you figure somebody's going to win 10, 20 bucks, whatever. Well, it went my way, and I kind of won every game. And we've been playing for maybe 20 or 30 minutes, and I might have been up, $60, $70, right? It was just one of those runaway things, right? And he was getting frustrated, man. He was getting really frustrated.
What's going on?
Yeah. He's just like, this isn't what's supposed to happen. And so he's getting more and more irritated and shooting balls harder and harder. And I'm just kind of like, I don't know, man, I'm just running out. And anyway, I run up to the 9-ball this time, and I shoot the 9-ball so bad, Rob. I shoot this thing down the rail. And I mean, I probably aimed it into the third diamond. And, it was one of those like Moscone Cup tables where it's like it hit the third diamond, it caught the outer point and hung up. But the 9-ball just kind of kept moving, and you could kind of see it rock and turn, and somehow it's like right before the 5 seconds is up, it just toppled in.
Oh,
and he's just bright red, and he's just like, he says to me, "That ball never would have gone on a diamond." And so I'm just like, I don't know what to tell you. The 9-ball went in, I lost, I paid, right? So then we rack up the balls, and I scratch on the break. And he takes ball in hand and slams onto the table, and he starts running through the balls, and he runs up to the 9-ball. And he shoots it even worse than I shot my 9-ball. He chunks it. And the ball shoots into the rail, catches the other point of the pocket, hangs up, starts to topple, and then just hangs there on the lip.
Hangs there, oh no.
And so he stands up, and he's just bright red, staring at the thing, about to like snap his cue or something. Oh, and I looked over, and I said, "That ball wouldn't go on a valley."
Oh, geez.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. I just had to share that.
Savage.
It was just a very funny line.
Yeah. Savage.
He set me up, man. He set me up. I couldn't help
Savage.
Myself.
Savage. That's funny.
So
that's a really funny story. All right, so I guess with that, we can wrap up this little discussion that we did. And this was a preliminary for what we're going to be doing next week, which I think is another really cool discussion. But I wanted to get this one in first. So from there, we will go on to our fan question of the week. And we actually had a couple people reach out with their fan questions. So thank you for doing that. And if you haven't, but you have a question in mind that you would like to have us discuss and talk about, please reach out to me or the podcast with your question. In fact, pause the podcast right now and go over and do it. We'll be back. We'll be here when you come back, I promise. All right. So let's get into this week's question. This is a question from Regina Wilson, and it's more or less in so many words. We've been talking about One Pocket a lot lately, and her question is basically, she loves One Pocket. She watched at one point in time 12 hours straight of One Pocket, but she was confused as to why maybe women don't get into it as much as men, or why women don't match up in these big matchups like the men do. And she basically was just asking us to chat about why we think that might be the case. So, Demetrius, why don't you take it away first?
Yeah, you're right. I didn't, and I guess I didn't notice it until I got the question. But yeah, I haven't seen a big matchup, and so just thinking about that, I think that there's I think that the answer is you will. I think the answer is you will. The reason I don't think it happened yet is because, first of all, you know, the people that are playing these One Pocket matches, the level they're playing at is really, really high. Like, I play the game pretty well, but I can't play with Tony Chohan and, you know, Josh Miller. And so the requisite skill to play the game is one that, if we go back 20 or 30 years, the women did not compete well enough to get in the ring with Josh Miller, which isn't a slight, because who is, you know, but that's just, the point is that it was beyond, the requisite skills weren't there. And then also, and that didn't really start happening. If we look at the Fargo rate of the women players though, you know, where was it in the 90s? You know, I remember watching AccuStats matches where a 1990 match where they were talking about the women's high run of the straight pool was 66 balls, and then it was eclipsed and somebody ran 67. Well, then you come to 2000, you've got Allison Fisher and Karen Kaur who are just playing, just absolutely laying it down and playing some great pool. And then you fast forward another 20 years and you've got Siming Chen, who's if maybe my favorite player in the world, and maybe the player who I think, maybe she doesn't play the best pool in the world, but if I had to pick one player to say this is how pool should be played, like she's my idea of what, you know, pool should be played like. And that, what a change over the last, you know, 30 years to go from, you know, having a 60 ball high run in straight pool to being, you know, Allison Fisher and Karen Kaur playing just jam up to Siming playing some of the best pool I've ever seen. And so there's been a talent curve as the women have increased. And so the requisite skills are there now. So, but that wasn't there years ago. And that was one of the reasons why we haven't seen this. The other reason is that if there's a change between kind of the, like I call it like the street fighter versus the gymnast. And again, in the past, you know, the U.S. players, at least, you know, it was more street fighters, you know, in the, you know, the 90s and stuff where, and before, everybody was a gunslinger and everybody was in these, you know, cash games where it was a lot of woofing and it was a lot of bluster and it was a lot of, you know, not necessarily great technical form. You know, Keith McCready, I mean, we all love Keith McCready, but that was like the symbol of American pool, right? It was a sidearm and some goofy fundamentals and a lot of attitude. And I'm not sure if that, you know, I don't know socially why that, you know, didn't jive, but I know that since things have gone to more of a gymnast approach, which is, no, we're not just a bunch of, you know, Wild West cowboys. We are world-class athletes. And that image, you know, and I think Karen Kaur and Allison Fisher really paved the way for that. They said, this is how pool should be played. And where, you know, when they were running out on, you know, on those nine ball racks in 2000, they were using good cue ball, good patterns, good fundamentals. And I think they really set the example that not only for the women players, but even a lot of the men players learned from that. And we've seen pool in general go more the route of the gymnast. So I think that the women are playing world-class pool now, and a lot of them are playing in more of a gymnast style. And I think that One Pocket used to be a gunfighter game, but now that it's becoming more mainstream and you're going to see more and more tournaments and books and the knowledge is coming more and more public, I think that One Pocket is going to go from a gunslinger game to a gymnast game as well. And that as the game becomes more mainstream and as the knowledge becomes more mainstream, and now that women have reached the highest levels of pool, in my opinion, and there's more and more of them, I think that the answer is you will see some world-class women One Pocket players, and it'll happen very, very, very soon.
Yeah, I got to think that you will see that too, and it won't be long. You know, hopefully, maybe a tournament, a One Pocket, how about a ladies One Pocket World Championship to start things off with? But I like, and really, as far as watching pool, what would personally look forward to that, seeing the best women players in the world tackle this game, because their mentality is they're built mentally to play one pocket. I just can't believe that. It's just got to be, as far as I'm concerned, I think they haven't been exposed to it as far as competition goes yet enough or often enough in their lives. But they're especially the European women, their snooker-style pocketing skills plus their ability to be the female and inherent ability to be patient about some things. You know, child rearing, patience, the patience you have to raise children, it's it's laughable. So I can see them really attacking this game and playing it well, playing it because it's not a well, I don't know, a game where you got to move that cue ball around the table a million places, you know. It's just not there that you don't have to do it. You just have to pocket, bank a little bit and pocket a few balls and play some defense.
Yeah, and I think it's the same kind of evolution. You know, it's like I was thinking about like rock climbing kind of went through something similar, right, where there was a day when rock climbing was like big manly men with the, you know, the huge arms, gorilla arms that would just pull themselves up a rock and be like, rah, rah, rah. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, there's actually a lot of technique and toning and refinement, and it's more of an athletic, you know, like, yeah. I said, more of a gymnast type thing. And then all of a sudden there's women that are doing just amazing things with rock climbing, and it's based on training and like I said, you know, toned, you know, obviously physical conditioning, but also technique, mental discipline, all these types of things. And it's, you know, and it's like, you know, we've seen women in the Olympics, you know, doing, you know, gymnastics and, you know, everything from ice skating to, you know, all kinds of they've done it all, and through training and conditioning and mental discipline. And I think that one pocket really lends itself well, because it's not a game of all out. It's, no. You know, not, it's just a very good game. Without a doubt, it's coming.
Getting on top of one pocket, the ladies, and being able to compete with the men in one pocket.
I would love to see, and I think I just can't wait till it happens. I would love to see Sabine Chen, you know, learn how to play one pocket and then play Tony Johann. I mean, I'd be betting on Sabine once she learns the game. You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah. I can't wait. So
It's funny thinking about one pocket as a game that can level a playing field in the sexes. What other pool game has in the past or whatever? I don't know. Ladies don't have.
Well, I think the top women, Rob, I think they're proving that they can level any game. That's my opinion. I understand. Yeah. Listen, I understand that there's, you know, a handful of men players, a handful of male players that are still technically developed beyond, but it's hard to say because, boy, it's getting very, very close, and the differences are getting very, very small, and there's a few things that you could almost, it's hard to even solve for. I mean, because people like Filler and Shane have such a big intimidation edge when they play their opposition that, you know, there's kind of something that happens when you get to that level where other people start dogging it to you and giving you extra opportunities that
maybe
you don't.
Do they play doubles one pocket at all? Or like mixed scotch or whatever, one pocket? Is that game even available?
I don't know, man. That's a tough one. You know, because one pocket is a game of where you have kind of it's not just a shot-by-shot game. It's like you're playing a strategy against kind of the overall ball layout and against your opponent and stuff. And so when you make it doubles, it kind of changes the game a little bit. I'm not a huge fan of doubles one pocket. No. But anyway, we're getting a little side here. What do you think, Nate? Jump in here. What do you think?
Nate, what do you think?
Well,
are you there? Did you go to sleep?
Just barely. I'm just barely here. Okay, so I guess this all ultimately comes down to this is where statistics and pool would be nice, right? Because predominantly the matchups that you see gambling are between men, and the big pool or the bigger pool tournaments are, again, predominantly men. And that's pretty much because I think the percentage of men in the game is higher. So now we can go into the question of why do we think that that is the case? Well, I don't know. I honestly have no idea. And I don't even really have any insights either, because Jennifer Beretta, I think, said it perfectly when she was on the podcast. There's no, she lost to her then fiance at the time, I think, or maybe it was her husband or boyfriend, whatever it was. She lost to her significant other at the time. And she said to herself, why did he beat me in this game? This makes zero sense. There's no real advantage to being a man as opposed to a woman in this game. And so he should not be adherently better at this when neither one of us have played the game hardly at all. And that was kind of her motivation to get better and beat her husband. So that kind of comes back to what I'm going to say right now, whereas I don't know why there seems to be significantly more men in the game than women. It seems to be a pretty gender neutral game where, of course, you know, you could break up the balls a little bit harder maybe by being a male. But as we're seeing from players like Tyler Steyer and Chang now, you don't have to break the balls at 26 miles an hour. In fact, Jeffrey DeLuna is like pretty much the only professional player I can think of right now that actually hits the ball seemingly at like 26, 27 miles an hour. He crushes the rack. Other than that, most people are going to a controlled 18 to 20 mile an hour pop break. And just about, I'm going to venture every professional woman player in the world has the technique and the mechanics to be able to swing at 18 miles an hour extremely comfortably. So it doesn't really make sense to me as to why men predominantly play the game more than women. Now, to my bigger point of this, it seems like men play one pocket and gamble in one pocket more, but I don't know that statistically that is the case, right? So if men make up 85% of the pool population, and I'm completely just making up stats here to make my broader point, so these statistics are completely out of nowhere and have no credibility at all, but we see on the big matchups that 100% of them are men, then it's not far off what the standard statistical data should say would be the matchups, right? So basically what I'm trying to get at here is the percentage of men in the game. I don't know that there is a significantly larger percentage of matches besides what it should be based off of the amount of men that play the game and the amount of matchups that are between men. I don't know that without actually seeing data. And that's kind of a kicking the can down the road and not really answering the question. But it's kind of, I guess I'm answering the question with, I don't know. I really don't know. It
could be something like men care more about their reputation in pool.
And Jennifer Beretta said that
ladies
once
do.
Basically. Jennifer Beretta said that once.
They don't care what their
standings
are here.
Well, I think there's two comments. First of all, Nate, as far as data, I mean, if there was some one pocket matches between women for cash at the high levels on these streams, then you could talk about it. But there's been none. I mean, there has been none. And so I'm not saying there haven't been any in the back rooms or anything, but like, so there's been none. So there's been zero representation. So then the only question is, will that continue? And I think the question, if we didn't think that was going to change, then we would have to answer, why are not women getting into one pocket and challenge matches? And then we can start looking at things like, are men more egotistical or all this stuff?
Hey,
but I actually think that the answer is there's no reason that women won't get into one pocket. And therefore, while they have not been represented until now, I think that's been because of a historic skill deficit against the top men players, or historic, you know, societal pressure or different types of games. But I think the answer is some of those things have been eliminated, and therefore you will see them represent themselves statistically in the right proportions in the one pocket events in the future. And I predict, like, if we wanted to go over to the action room on AC Billiards and talk about when you're going to see women start snapping off one pocket tournaments, it's going to be, we're talking months and years. We're not talking decades.
So I guess I hope that answered your question. It was a fun conversation to have. I tried to walk a line, and I don't like to be the podcast that has discussions about women for women. I don't want to be that type of I don't want to be that voice in the world. So I tried to walk the line as best I could, and I don't think I did very well, but that's what editing is for. All right, so we can move on from there, and we can go on to, all right, so now we can head into Demetrius's Coach's Corner. Demetrius, take it away.
Hey, guys, welcome to another edition of the Coach's Corner. my part of the podcast where I get to help you try to get more out of your pool game. You can learn more about me at www.mnpoolbootcamp.com, MN like Minnesota. I'd like you guys to check it out. I think I've mentioned this, but one thing is get to know me a little bit. Go to my website, check it out a little bit, read some of the testimonials about people that have come out and trained with me for a few days and how it's changed, how they see the pool table. But it also answers a lot of questions. I've gotten some emails, and please check out my website. And then if you still have questions, reach out to me directly. I'd love to hear from you. This week, what's on my mind is something that I think is paramount, the most important thing. And that is, you know, maybe the biggest mistake that I think people make. And it's a strange one because I understand why they make it. But what's odd to me is that they don't question. They don't ever challenge. And they can make the same mistake for 20, 30, 40 years. And it can kind of destroy their pool career. It's weird. So what that is when we play pool, when we get down to it, we play pool to enjoy the game. We play pool for fun. And there's fun when you win, and there's fun when you improve, and there's fun when you make good shots. But when you're successful in pool, it's very enjoyable and satisfying. And ultimately, that's what we're after. You know, when we first started playing pool, it's like, hey, this game is fun. And so we were enjoying the game. And then somewhere along the lines, we realized, like, maybe we started taking the game more seriously. We went from being recreational players to amateur players. And we started, you know, taking the game more seriously. And we had days where we'd make those shots that we'd trained ourselves how to make. And we'd use that aiming system to pocket a ball that we couldn't have pocketed before. Or that bank shot would actually go in. And that would be really satisfying. And so somewhere along the lines, we'd say, boy, I played well today, and that was really fun. And so our goal is to extract the maximum joy and out of the game we can. And we realize, boy, when I play better, I really enjoy myself. I've got an idea. What if I played well all the time? Then I would enjoy myself all the time, and I would extract the most fun possible. So I've got an idea. I want to enjoy myself all the time, so I'm going to play good all the time. And the way I'm going to do that, to make sure I'm having all the fun I can have, okay, in order to get all the fun I can have out of this game, I'm going to make sure I play good all the time. And the way I'm going to do that is if I ever play bad, I will punish myself. And I will get mad at myself. And I will criticize myself. And I will sting myself and say, that was terrible. You couldn't miss that shot. What are you doing wrong? And that way, if I punish myself every time I make a mistake, then I'll quit making those mistakes, and then I'll play good all the time, and then I'll have fun playing as much of the time as possible, and I'll just be playing great all the time and enjoying myself all the time. It's almost like Deathstroke is a beautiful bird, and we're trying to put it in a cage and force it. And so then what happens is, with the strategy, is that people start making mistakes, and they start whipping themselves and beating themselves and criticizing themselves, and then they put all this pressure on themselves when they're afraid to make a mistake. Because if they do, they know they're going to go through all this misery, and it creates, and then they start controlling, and they start being too analytical and controlling and forced, and next thing you know, they're beating themselves up, and they have a miserable day on the pool table. They don't play well, and they do this session after session, month after month, year after year. And I've met people that have spent the last 30, 40 years of their life putting in miserable sessions on the pool table. And here's the part that I really, really don't get. You develop this strategy in your head, and it kind of makes sense, right? It kind of makes sense when you first concoct the strategy that, hey, I'm going to force myself to play good so I enjoy the game more. But if the result of that strategy is years and years of misery, at what point do we go back and revisit this and say, it was a good theory, but in practice, this isn't really working out to where I'm enjoying the game more. The reality is that if you decide to try to beat yourself, whip yourself, or punish yourself, or zap yourself when you make errors and mistakes in an effort to play better, it turns out that it doesn't work, and you just make yourself miserable and zap yourself. And that's not, it doesn't work. And now there's a follow-up questions where people can say, well, what's going to motivate you then? And what's going to teach you not to make those mistakes? And how do you, you know, I need to, you know, if you don't punish yourself when you make mistakes, that's not going to you're not going to be motivated to get better and blah, blah, blah. And those are sub conversations about like, I disagree. I think that I'm, you know, frankly, not only am I plenty motivated, but I'm much more motivated since I'm not emotionally fatigued from the torture I exert on myself constantly. So I have kind of a childlike enthusiasm, and I'm more excited about what's going well than I think. And I think that we've seen this with training dogs, and we've seen this with employee morale. Like, we don't need to be heavy handed and belittling and punishing to get results. And so, but anyway, there's all these questions about, well, what about motivation and how am I going to learn to change? And I need to teach myself and train myself. But I think that without going down those spin-off conversations, I think that the answer is no. It's been pretty well proven that you don't need heavy-handed punishment. And in terms of effective strategy, though, even if you don't get better at pool, or whether or not your skill level goes up, like separating skill, if the ultimate reason why we're playing pool is to enjoy the game, then I just wanted to call to people's attention that making yourself miserable for hours on the pool table in an effort to play better and hence enjoy the game does not work. It's better to go the opposite way, which is, how about this strategy? How about I will enjoy myself playing pool today and then try my best? And by doing that, you know, sometimes you're going to enjoy yourself. Sometimes you'll then go on and play well. Sometimes you might not. But you'll at least accomplish the goal of enjoying yourself if you don't tie your happiness with your level of performance. And so that's my recommendation. Don't tie your enjoyment of the game to your level of performance. The most important quote I've ever heard about pool is this: when you play to have fun, you win as soon as you put your pool cue together. And so if you're one of these people that has spent the last 20 or 30 years punishing yourself in an effort to enjoy the game, please take a second look at that and see how it's actually working for you. And I'd recommend just reevaluating and seeing if maybe we should make this the other way around. So, all right, guys, thanks for your time. And I guess I'll catch you next week.
Okay, Demi. Thank you.
Pretty good wrap up there. So, yep, like Demi said, I'll see you guys next week, and have a good one.